Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 249. The invasion of Zululand did not arrive suddenly. It had been constructed brick by brick over the preceding months through decisions made in distant offices and on dusty border farms. By early January 1879, the machinery of British imperial confidence was fully wound, and the commanders in Natal believed they were about to conduct a short, sharp campaign to correct what they regarded as a troublesome frontier problem. For the people living along that frontier, the mood was more complex. Rumour travelled fast, and the Zulu intelligence network was already humming with accurate reports of British movements. Settlers and colonial units in Natal, meanwhile, watched the gathering storm with a mixture of unease and bravado. The Boers, who had faced Zulu power before, offered advice the British would soon wish they had followed. And so, as the new year opened, both sides prepared for a conflict neither truly understood. The British approached with modern rifles, rockets, and the calm assurance of empire. The Zulu prepared with discipline, speed, and an intelligence system that outperformed anything Chelmsford could muster. All that remained was for the first column to step across the river. January 11th, 1879. The rainy season in Zululand lasts from January to March, so the going would be muddy and the rivers flooding. But most importantly, there would be lots of sweet green grass for the thousands of oxen and horses. The fuel tank of Mother Nature was full. The British were keen to exploit their power and were going to cross the border using ox-drawn wagons. Chelmsford had built up supplies of these machines, along with other material and ammunition. For the European army, the campaign was standard colonial warfare, distance and natural obstacles to be overcome as much as the enemy. Commander Lord Chelmsford had assembled 10,023 oxen, 398 mules, 977 wagons, and 56 carts to lumber supplies for his troops. These average only 20 kilometers a day and soaked up large numbers of troops. In this campaign, the columns would become bogged down in the mud and could barely average 10 kilometers a day. The build-up to this momentous conflict has taken us two episodes to complete because everything that happens after the next 24 months will project South Africa into the 20th century. The narratives created here by all people, the Zulu, the British, the Boers, black and white, the coloured Achterreiers and the drivers, the Indian cane cutters of the time, the Nordic and German and other missionaries, even the American missionaries, the drawing of maps, surveying of land, politics and culture will all be affected by this war. On the eve of the invasion, Lord Chelmsford had declared martial law along the borders with Zululand. The Boers and the settlers who fought alongside his army met Chelmsford and advised him to adopt the standard lager once inside enemy territory, a proven technique of holding out against vast numbers of warriors. Chelmsford ignored this advice from people he regarded as lower on the imperial ladder, but also because it took a great deal of time and effort to wheel the wagons into a circle, then outspan the oxen, and even longer to reverse this procedure and inspan. He was going to learn a dreadful lesson in a few days and would begin lagering his troops as advised, but too late for 1,500 of his men. He had initially planned to break his 17,000-strong army into five columns and to invade Zululand from different points, all joining up to converge at Quechua Kampande's great place, Undini, modern-day Ulundi. By breaking up the columns, Chelmsford was hoping they would move faster across wet Zululand. On the eve of the invasion, though, Chelmsford realized there weren't enough wagons nor transport officers available to spread amongst five columns. His army agents had denuded the civilian economy of Natal by offering inflated prices for wagons. He was forced to trim the number of columns down to three, the same number of columns in a Zulu attack with their two horns and a central chest tactic. These two combative nations were deploying similar ideas, the center crashing into the foe as the two wings fold around them from the sides like the thumbs pressed together and hands throttling an enemy. Chelmsford selected an invasion route with Zulu mobility in mind. As he was about to empty Natal of most of its protection, it would be ripe for invasion, so he picked their likely invasion points as his point of entry. One of the three columns was to advance across the lower Tugela, a natural weak point, along the coastal plain, then up into the mountains of Ishowe. The second was to cross Rorke's Drift near Dundee and to make for Undini. The third was to ford the Ngomi, the Blood River from the Transvaal. All three of these columns would join up prior to the final assault on Ondini. To use a chess analogy, this was a mutual initiative position, although it was the British invading. Chelmsford understood that, like Napoleon's army, the Zulu relied on local Imezis for their supplies, corn, meat, other goods. His plan was to destroy all Zulu homesteads as the slow British beast rumbled through Zululand. They would eliminate what Chelmsford and his officers called legitimate military targets, pillaging grain and loot, all the cattle they could find, and then setting fire to the huts. The most effective means of defeating the Zulu was going to be by starving them. Chelmsford was relying on a quick victory. He wanted to avoid the guerrilla-style campaign that had recently been fought in the Eastern Cape, where the Ninth Frontier War had ground on for 2 years. He wanted to lure Cetshwayo's aggressive Amabutu into a battle where he hoped the superiority of their arms and battlefield tactics would lead to a quick British victory. We should consider his view as a logical move militarily. The British had artillery and rockets, the Gatling gun. It was a machine gun wheeled around behind horses or mules, and his men were armed with modern rapid-firing rifles. Against these were the AmaZulu, who mainly carried old-fashioned muskets and rifles, and tended to prefer the stabbing spear anyway. The Martini Henry was the main rifle carried by the British and could fire 12 rounds a minute. This marked a significant shift in weapons technology. Muskets took at least a minute to fire and load by comparison. However, new recruits were trained to slow down, firing 3 rounds a minute, less waste, more accuracy. A slow and measured volley of fire was physically destructive and psychologically devastating. The Martini Henry round was a bone-shattering .50 and weighed a hefty 480 grains. Crucially, in South Africa's vast rolling landscape, it was accurate up to 360 metres, but it had weaknesses. It suffered many jams in the hot African sun. Its recoil was like being kicked in the shoulder, and after 10 rounds, apart from the intense pain, many troops began to flinch and the accuracy was compromised. After 10 or 20 shots, the breech could become thick with greasy gunpowder and the barrel burned at the touch. Troops learned to tie a strip of cowhide around the forestock to protect the tips of their fingers as they curled close to the barrel. The Gatling gun sprayed around 200 rounds a minute, a hand-cranked murderous tool used in early colonial wars and during the American Civil War. Mules pulled their 7-pounder guns, light enough to pull over the African terrain, and that weapon fired explosive anti-personnel and shrapnel rounds. The hail rockets were also carted into Zululand, 9-pounders which had stabilized tails like darts. They were terrifying but wholly inaccurate, hissing and roaring, and sometimes the fin didn't work and the rocket would produce a banshee-like shriek as it corkscrewed through the air. It was in the area of intelligence, however, that Cetshwayo was ahead of Chelmsford. Whereas the British had no idea about where the Zulu army was most of the time, once the British entered Zululand, Cetshwayo was provided daily updates about the movement of his enemy. Even the smaller reconnaissance patrols were under scrutiny. He had a network of spies throughout the region, from beyond southern Natal all the way to Delagoa Bay, and into the Transvaal. If you've listened to the series, you'll remember how the Zulu and other military societies like the Basutu and the Amandebele valued accurate information at a time of war. Zulu spies were extremely detailed gatherers of data. An oral society, after all, prides itself on being able to memorize long lists of facts and figures. The number of troops, the horses, guns, direction of movement, the names of the commanders, even their character type, all flowed into the Zulu heartland, and Cetshwayo and his counselors hungrily consumed this data. Some of these spies had even infiltrated the columns and were working as servants. The British tried to stymie the system. Natal's Lieutenant Governor Bulwer, for example, was informed of Zulu spies along the Drakensberg near Basutoland and others south of Pondoland. He issued an order that any Zulu found in Natal without a refugee pass would be arrested. The British became obsessed about being watched, their troops constantly glancing into the mountains they passed, aware that they were under constant scrutiny. There was not a moment that soldiers felt safe in this territory. Cetshwayo mobilized around 29,000 warriors and gathered his senior military commanders at Ondini to discuss strategy. Before the invasion, they believed the British would likely attack via Delagoa Bay, disembarking their troops in the north and marching them down into Zululand. Zulu harbored an obsession about the North. After all, the Ndwandwe, the Swazi, and the Amatsonga, and others, had tested the power of Zulu kings from there for generations. The Zulu initial strategy was to wait and see where the British entered, then engage them with the bulk of the army while launching a counterstrike with a smaller force into Natal. Cetshwayo was acutely aware that the British had an almost unending supply of resources and that he would lose a long war. Perhaps, if he shocked them with an outflanking counterattack, they'd reconsider their war to protect their settlers in Natal. His spies had told him that the central column crossing in the region of Rorke's Drift was the strongest, and their commander was Chelmsford. This column was bolstered by a large group of Boers who fought alongside the British. Cetshwayo wanted to crack the hardest nut first, so he focused his largest force against this section and dispatched a smaller force to the coast to monitor the British crossing the lower Tugela. Another group of what you could call local irregulars congregated around Inkandla Forest just in case the British came through the middle Tugela. This left Ondini underprotected and vulnerable to a dash by mounted units. The reality was Lord Chelmsford was going to enter Zululand with very few mounted men, so there was no chance of a dash directly to Ondini. The spies had told Cetshwayo as much, but he pulled together a 1,000-member home guard anyway, relying on the veterans, some who'd fought in Blood River in 1838 against the Boers. They were in their 60s by now and would be joined by the Utlambedlu Ubuntu, who were in their mid-50s, and the Indaba Kawambi Regiment, almost 58 years old. It was 40 years since the Zulu had fought against the European-style army, and their tactics had hardly changed in that time, whereas the British had introduced an entirely new form of warfare, sharpened by the Indian Mutiny and the Amatxhosa Wars, and a war in Afghanistan. At about 2 a.m. on Saturday, the 11th of January, 1879, the quiet of the African night along the banks of the Imzinyati was broken by the piercing cry of bugles sounding the reveil. A full moon was overhead. The troops formed up, horse harnesses clanked, wagon wheels creaked, oxen were lowering. Lead troops of Lieutenant Colonel Richard Glynn's No. 3 Column took advantage of mist to cross the Imzinyati, or the Buffalo River, at the soon-to-be world-famous Rorke's Drift. They had begun their march from nearby Help Makar. Glynn was a short and pugnacious officer who waxed his moustache and possessed an evil temper. Born and raised in India, he'd gained experience during the suppression of the Indian Mutiny and used the funds he'd saved in that campaign to buy himself a colonelcy in the 1st 24th Regiment. Yes, officers in the British Army bought their positions. It wasn't the other way around. He'd brought the regiment to South Africa in 1875 and fought the Amatxhosa during the 9th Frontier War, gaining plaudits and a CB from Queen Victoria. By the time they forded the Imzinyati River, they were no longer sunburned red. They'd turned a deep mahogany brown, and all were heavily bearded. Their red tunics had faded, and they'd learned to remove the bright brass regimental plate, which was an excellent target for snipers, from their helmets. They dyed their white helmets brown with boiled mimosa bark or a mixture of tea and coffee. Some men had even ditched their helmets and were wearing Boer-like wide-brimmed hats. 7 companies of the 1st Battalion 24th 2nd Warwickshire Regiment of Foot, or 1st and 24th from here on, and the Sister Battalion 2nd and 24th, as well as a battery of Royal Artillery. Trotting ahead, a mixture of settler-mounted units, the European Horse, who included police and volunteers. 2 battalions of the Natal Native Contingent joined them, and a company of Natal Native Pioneers. The creation of the Pioneers was Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Durnford's brainchild, arguing in a memorandum in September that each column needed a force of men to repair roads and to throw up earthworks. 300 refugees of the Zulu civil wars living in Natal were raised for distribution amongst the columns as pioneers. They were armed with rifles, but also carried picks and shovels and wore a British uniform. Earlier, Chelmsford had asked Durnford put together a body of black auxiliaries, infantry, apart from the pioneers. They were named the Natal Native Contingent, and a total of 7,000 had been recruited and were folded into these 3 columns. Each NNC battalion was composed of 10 companies of 3 white mounted officers, 6 white NCOs, and 100 Africans. But only 1 in 10 of the Africans was armed with a rifle, an outdated Snider breech loader. Some even had the older muzzle-loading Enfields. The Lieutenant Governor turned down Durnford's request for every black soldier to be issued a rifle. Bulwer was wary about arming Africans. Even in the midst of relying on the Allies, the Natal officials couldn't quite shake their distrust of their motives. The majority therefore carried assegais and shields. The only real distinguishing mark was the red bandana around their heads. A quick reminder about Durnford. He'd been involved in the hunt for Amahlubi chief Langala Belele in Basutoland in 1873. He led a group up the Bushman's River Pass and ended up in a firefight with Langali Balele's rear guard, during which he was stabbed in the side and elbow, severing a nerve in his arm. The operation was a fiasco. Three colonial carbineers died alongside three black soldiers, and he was blamed for this disaster. Later, he'd also formed a close, some would say inappropriate, relationship with Bishop John Colenso's daughter, Frances Ellen, or Fanny, as she was known. Inappropriate, not because of promiscuousness, because Bishop Colenso and Fanny were liberal humanists, and the settlers of Natal and the whole were not. Glynn led 1,891 white troops and 2,400 Africans, while staff officers and civilians brought the number up to 4,700 in total. All logistics were carried in 220 wagons pulled by 2,000 oxen and 82 carts pulled by 67 mules. Captain William Simons of the 2nd 24th wrote during the invasion that a marching column took more than an hour before the rear files had cleared a single bend in the road. Two hawsers, long hemp ropes, had been stretched across the Mzinyati. The rainy season had swollen the river. Glynn ordered the colonial troops, who were mounted men of the volunteers and a battalion of the Natal native contingent, to cross first. Would the Zulu oppose the crossing? No one was certain, just in case a 7-pound artillery battery was set up to cover the crossing. It was dawn when the mist began to rise thickly off the river, as it does in South Africa, swallowing up the troops. Because it was a dangerous moment, Chelmsford had selected a place upstream, one of the widest parts of the river, where there were no ravines, so he could ford safely. But that meant the crossing took far longer, and the battalion of Natal native contingent men held onto a hawser and each other in a long line of men as a rope. Some were worried about crocodiles, which still inhabited these rivers of Zululand, and the men began to hum deeply. The sound trembled in the thick mist, creating an unearthly atmosphere. Upriver, the mounted volunteers, who'd picked an alternative spot, were almost on the other side when journalist Charles Noggs Norris Newman spurred his horse, determined to make history. It is an irony of this war that the first person to invade Zululand was not a soldier, but a journalist, Norris Newman of the London Standard. He'd taken to wearing the Natal native contingent's distinguishing mark, a red scarf tied around his sun helmet. Norris Newman was also a stringer for two Cape newspapers. And it's even more an irony that so oblivious were the British press to events in South Africa that Norris Newman was the only correspondent covering the war. As you know, Cape Governor Sir Bartle Frere had been warned by his superiors in London not to provoke a war, and how he had withheld the Border Commission report to ensure a war was going to be forced on the Zulu without the Colonial Office interference. Some of the best journalists of the day were on hand to cover the closing stages of Chelmsford's conquest of the Cape frontier. But so successful had Frere been in obfuscating his true intent in Zululand that they had all abandoned Africa and headed off to Afghanistan, where another war was raging. Such was his success that not one other British journalist realized how serious the situation had become in South Africa. Noggs had joined the central column because, like Cetshwayo, he'd guessed it was where the main action would take place. Just by the way, Noggs was Charles Dickens' character Newman Noggs from Nicholas Nickleby. As Noggs wrote proudly later, "I was actually the first man in Zululand after war was declared." It would prove to be the first of a number of dramatic scoops Noggs Newman would enjoy over the following fortnight. The sun soon burned off the mist and revealed the countryside of rolling green hills. The only Zulu in sight was a solitary herdsman who had stopped in his tracks as the British army marched up. The Natal Volunteer Corps, the settlers, galloped up to him and relieved him of his herd, saluting in the name of the Queen. Marching in step behind them, a Matlunu chief, Gabangai, reminded his men of the Natal native contingent while they were fighting. They hated the Zulu, and no one more so than Gabangai. As the troops marched, Gabangai rushed back and forth alongside his men, recounting the Amatlunu history, how they'd suffered at the hands of the Zulu. He did this for an hour, Often his tirade would be applauded by the NNC shouting, "Hee-ah!" and the entire contingent would hammer their spears against their shields. The column marched along in sunshine and the temperature rose rapidly. They had no shortage of water. They were veterans of African wars, but even so, the heat sapped their energy. "Even the London boatmen could not curse," wrote NNC officer Lieutenant Henry Harford. When they halted, the native contingent used their shields for shade. A patrol was sent out to scout the land. Chelmsford was growing concerned. Where was the enemy? He'd asked Major Dartnell to ride to nearby hills and take a look around. Colonial Mounted Rifles Lieutenant Charlie Hartford joined him. They rode out of the Imzinyati Valley along the pitted track, then looked down into the Abachi Valley nearby, before turning left and following a stream towards the known homestead of the Kwasokgetle. In front, large fields of corn, millies, a late thriving crop, sparkling deep green and glinting in the sun. The valley appeared eerily deserted until they heard a sound. Lieutenant Hartford described it. "We heard a war song being sung, evidently by a large body of natives. But where were they? What had become of them? We were unable to find out." The Amabuto had melted away like the mist. The NNC and the Natal volunteers seized 300 cattle from the Amakungambeni homesteads around the Bache Valley with some ease. However, the whereabouts of the enemy was now deeply troubling Chelmsford. What were the Zulu tactics? They had three main options. Lead the British into a battle of their choosing, guerrilla warfare, or would they fight at all? He knew that last option was highly unlikely. There were important strategic and political imperatives requiring him to make an early and decisive contact with the enemy. Strategically, it would take him days to move his entire column across the river and establish a secure depot on the Zulu bank of the Imzinyati. If the Amabuto didn't show up soon and his main column pushed onwards, he'd leave the depot exposed. Governor Sir Bartle Frere had told the colonial office that the Amakungambeni's Mehlo Kazulu was a threat, the killing of the two women a central plank in their justification for invasion, as you heard in the previous episode. If the same communities now proved to be docile and compliant, there was a real risk that Frere's carefully cultivated image of the Zulu bogeyman might be exposed as a sham. The sounds of a large Amabuto had been heard by Hartford and Dartnell. That could indeed be the Amakungambeni preparing for battle. Chelmsford circulated a fresh order that the column be ready to march out at dawn and locate these warriors. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about this episode and others. You can also email me from there and sign up for my newsletter. Until next, Saligatli.